You're listening to Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I am Ira Flatow. Up next this hour, some new views of the cosmos. The New York Post calls it Miracle in Space, splashed across its front page. When was the last time that a big tabloid newspaper, any of them, were so excited by news from space that did not involve alien abduction? What's so exciting? Were pictures coming back from the Cassini spacecraft. But what is causing the excitement? The excitement is coming from these terrific photographs, and it shows you just how powerful a message a good picture can pack. And it isn't great pictures that make most of us interested in astronomy, is it? It's these great pictures. And planetariums know this when they create their own sky shows. Joining me next is one of the people behind what promised to be just such a dramatic sky show, Cosmic Collisions. It opens next week at the Hayden Planetarium at New York's American Museum of Natural History. Joining me now to talk about it is Michael Shara. He is a curator of astrophysics at the American Museum of Natural History and also curator of the new planetarium show, Cosmic Collisions. Welcome to Science Friday, Dr. Shara.
Hi, thanks. Nice to be back.
Thank you. Tell us what makes this show different from other kinds of planetarium shows we've seen before.
The planetarium shows that we do are in very high resolution, and they involve using simulations. So these are not cartoons and they're not animations. We actually take real data from supercomputers, some of which we generate ourselves in our own astrophysics department, others of which we go to the world experts around the world who've computed these things, take their data and then render them and show them on our giant dome. So what we're showing the public is the kind of thing that scientists look at themselves and use themselves to try to understand cosmic phenomena.
Now, cosmic collisions implies we're going to see things banging and screaming, screeching together on the dome there.
That's exactly right. There are a lot of real car crashes, not just fender benders that go on in the cosmos. And we want to illustrate that this happens on every kind of scale, from the collisions between protons in the core of the sun, which, of course, drives the sun and drives the evolution of stars, to asteroidal collisions, which do in the dinosaurs, and if we're not careful about it, could eventually do us in, to collisions between stars, and even all the way on up to collisions between galaxies, which transform galaxies from one kind to another. So we really want to get across the message that these collisions are transformative, that they're really a kind of driver of evolution, if you will, an analog of natural selection.
1-800-989-8255, talking about the Cosmic Collisions program at the Planetarium Show at the American Museum of Natural History, Hayden Planetarium in New York. I would imagine that as a show person, and the showmanship, there's got to be showmanship involved here, that the whole collision motif has to come out from watching, you know, television or other shows where cars, as you say, are banging against each other and knowing what the public may want to come to a planetarium to see.
The fact that we're in the edutainment business hasn't escaped any of us. We, of course, want our audience to be entertained as well as enlightened about what's going on in astrophysics. But I'm pretty proud to say that what we really are showing is astrophysics 101. These are the various processes that astrophysicists really do study. The fact that they happen to be violent, that they transform objects, and that they're visually beautiful makes it rather easy for us, in a sense, to put the show on. But it really is both beautiful astrophysics and phenomenally entertaining collisions that we're showing.
And it was made in a big computer at the museum, right? You have your own design of...
We do. We specialize in things like collisions of galaxies, what happens when galaxies crash into each other, and following these objects on supercomputers with self-consistent star formation and shockwaves and all that sort of stuff that goes on. Picturing and imaging globular clusters, some of the oldest objects in the universe, and other kind of research we do. But we also went, for example, to our colleague Galen Gisler at the Los Alamos National Labs when we wanted the state-of-the-art simulation of an asteroid crashing into the Earth. He's done what we think is the best such simulation. And we went to Robin Knupp when we wanted the best simulation of what happens when a Mars-like object, a huge object, crashes into the Earth to help form the Moon early in the history of the solar system. So we don't have all the expertise in astrophysics here, not by a long shot, And by going to these experts around the country who've done, and around the world, who've done some fantastic work, we've made the show, I think, that much better.
How flexible is this? How flexible can you be in a show like this? And I imagine, as opposed to the old days of the Zeiss, you know, telescope, the projectors on a ceiling, with an organic computer program, possibly you can be more flexible with updating and upgrading the news that you get. For example, there's news, you're talking about cosmic collisions, there's news in the last week or so about the moons of Pluto.
Right.
And, you know, the news today that it appears that all three moons may have been formed by some cosmic collision.
Right, and the certainly the collisions that we show, both the one that formed our own moon and the one that did in the dinosaurs, really bring out a lot of the physics of collisions of asteroidal and planetary-sized bodies with each other. Now, we can't just pull the proto-lunar collision and pull in or push in one that might simulate the evolution of Pluto. We just don't have enough data to be able to do that. But the
you also would have to have Robert Redford come back and revoice.
He's really gracious about doing this.
I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt you. Yeah,
very lucky to get him to narrate the show for us.
So it is not quite that flexible that you can just mix and match pieces as the news comes up.
No, in many ways, this is like putting together a Hollywood production, a movie. There's an original movie score. Of course, Robert Redford is narrating it. And there's a dramatic theme and flow to it. We want it to be entertaining as well as educational.
1-800-989-8255 is our number. Let's go to the phones. Let's go to Don in Fredonia, Arizona. Hi, Don.
Hi, how you doing, Neil?
Hi, go ahead. No, this is Ira today.
Oh, it's Ira. I'm sorry.
That's okay.
Ira, my question was, I know that they're looking to do something theatrical with this, but when you just hit on the part of the knowledge, what about the planet Saturn, the new finding they had about the water geysers? Do they plan to do anything with that?
Good question, Michael.
The geysers themselves aren't going to appear in the space show. Remember, that was a news release exactly 24 hours ago. This is a movie show that we've been planning for over a year and assembling for over a year. But we do have a weekly electronic newspaper that goes up on a giant screen in the Hayden Planetarium called our Astro Bulletin, and it's also at many other science centers around the United States. And I can guarantee you that the geysers will be in the Astro Bulletin next week. It's the obvious story to cover.
Okay,
right,
would that be available? Is that available to get, that news bulletin?
It is if you happen to live near the Wright Science Center. Probably the thing to do is to check the website, amnh.org.
Alrighty.
And also take a look at amnh.org/cosmic. Which will
all right.
A lot about the
very much.
Show.
You certainly got the Arizona Science Center there in Arizona, so.
Yes, we do.
Good luck to you.
Thank you much.
You're welcome. 1-800-989-8255. While we're talking about Enceladus and the guys around there, you want to fill us in on anything that has impressed you? I know you're the point person at the planetarium on this issue.
We're really spectacularly impressed with the images, and I mean, really, really beautiful. And of course, it makes the point that there is liquid water available on Enceladus. The fact that you have a 300-mile diameter object, something that small, which has liquid water near the surface, is not something that you might have predicted right off the top of your head. And of course, it's really exciting because it's another place for us to go and potentially look for life. A lot of time and effort, of course, has been put into looking for water on Mars, because if you want to look for life, looking for water is a good thing to do first. Here we have a much smaller object that really does seem to have liquid water within a few tens of feet, or at most 100 feet of its surface. Just a remarkable finding.
Yeah, and I'm also shocked myself a bit to see what kind of incredible coverage it has gotten. You know, it's front page of the New York Post today. You know, it's all over the place.
Yeah, it's touched a nerve, and that is because I think the public is really interested, as we astronomers are, in trying to answer that really basic question: are we alone, or is there life elsewhere in the universe? And the fact that we're making some headway on answering this question after just wondering and spinning our wheels for many thousands of years as a species, that's pretty remarkable. I think that's really cool.
Mm-hmm. Are we sure that it's really water coming out of that geyser?
The science team has said that there's a very high probability that that's true, and I think that they've been appropriately cautious in their statements. Nobody has actually been able to go in and take a sample yet, and the water hasn't been passed through a mass spectrometer. But given the qualities, that is, given the images that you see of the material being ejected from Enceladus, given the fact that there was a lot of oxygen detected by Cassini on the way in, probably some of that water being dissociated as it comes off the surface of Enceladus, I would say that there's a very strong circumstantial case. Mm-hmm. And it's also going to push NASA scientists to think hard about how to go back and confirm it and maybe get down onto the surface and do some really close-up searching for life.
They're going to have to appropriate some more money to do that. To get
it doesn't come free.
Yes. 1-800-989-8255. Karen in Old Saybrook, Connecticut. Hi, Karen.
Well, good afternoon, Ira. Your show is my favorite on NPR, and thank you for taking my call.
Well, thank you. That's very nice of you to say that.
I wanted to ask your guest, it's my understanding that space is essentially the eternal vacuum. So when these celestial bodies or organizations collide, are they absolutely free of sound, or have you been able to determine that there are atmospheres involved that would involve large noise? Hello?
What a great question. Hang on, we'll get the answer.
I'll take it off. Thank you.
Okay, thank you.
There's a multi-parted answer. If you were standing on Earth and an asteroid crashed into Earth, well, the shockwave would propagate around through the atmosphere. And if you were far enough away that you weren't roasted or blown apart, you would hear that shockwave, so you'd certainly hear the sound. It's true that when, say, two galaxies collide with each other in intergalactic space, there's a pretty hard vacuum out there, less than one particle per cubic centimeter, so trillions of times more tenuous an atmosphere than there is on Earth, and it's certainly fair to say that in that case, there aren't sound waves. That doesn't stop us from rumbling the seats in the theater to emphasize the crashing nature of some of these collisions.
Talking with Michael Shara of the Rose Center Hayden Planetarium on Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News. Michael, that brings up a good point and something we talk about a lot when we talk about accuracy. You know, when you watch science fiction movies, the physics is they break a lot of laws of physics, the way the spaceships move around and sound in space during collisions and zapping things, making sounds. Do you strive for more accuracy when you think about putting a planetarium show together? Do you think about those sorts of things?
We do a lot. And while we'll use this, these sort of vibrating seats to emphasize the nature of a crash, the physics that you see up on the screen or the collision that you see up on the screen really is the most accurate that we know how to do with our physics. And again, these are not animations. These are simulations. We take the laws of physics, Newton's laws, electromagnetism, gravity, put them all into computers, and what we get out, of course, are streams of millions of numbers, incomprehensible by themselves, but use them to draw the pictures, the images, of what happens when objects collide. So the image that you see of two galaxies colliding, something we could never see with our own eyes because the process takes half a billion years, we think is what happens, and the predictions that come out of these kinds of simulations of the evolution of galaxies and the transformation of, say, spiral galaxies to elliptical galaxies, these are really things that we see in the cosmos today. So we have a great deal of confidence that what we're showing is the most scientifically accurate representation possible.
Mm-hmm. Rodney, Oklahoma City, welcome to Science Friday.
Yeah, thank you, and I, too, love your show.
My
question is in regards to how planetariums across the country share information and when this show is going to be at a planetarium in Oklahoma soon.
I can't give you the specific answer for Oklahoma, but Planetaria and the directors of Planetaria and the people who work at them talk to each other regularly. There are various Planetarium associations. We sell our planetarium shows to planetaria around the country, you do need to have a digital planetarium. The space show that we're producing now, that many new planetaria are now producing and showing, cannot be shown on the old-fashioned Zeiss projector because it's not a show that's based on Earth. It's based in space. So you need projectors that can fill up your entire dome. As for your specific planetarium, the only thing I can do is ask you to call them and ask them if they would consider perhaps showing this show. We think it's state-of-the-art, and we'd love to see it in Oklahoma.
Do planetaria ever still show the old stars at night, what to see, you know, in this season?
They do. The Zeiss projector is used in a couple of our other space shows, and we do at least once or twice a week special Zeiss shows. That is for people who just want to see the stars. But today, much of the planetarium community is moving towards increasingly high-resolution digital projectors, which give us much more flexibility to be able to move off the Earth, watch things like galaxies or stars colliding, show the most state-of-the-art astrophysical simulations, not just the stars at night. We love to do that, too.
Yeah. Yeah,
you got to be able to do both.
What makes your like an IMAX then not a competitor to yours? If they're you're basically showing a creation of film, why not just put it on an IMAX?
Many of the planetarium shows actually are on an IMAX basis. That is, they can be shown on IMAX theaters, on IMAX type screens, in IMAX type theaters. As well as our own dome. Of course, we're producing the shows principally, our first and most important driver is for our own audience. We show it to millions of people every year here in New York City. But, of course, we want it seen around the world, too. So we translate from our own platform, from the particular projectors we have, into others. And that's why many planetaria can show them around the world.
Dr. Shara, good luck in your new cosmic collisions.
Thanks very much.
Thanks for joining us. Michael Shara, curator of astrophysics, American Museum of Natural History. Stay with us. We're going to switch gears and come back and talk about the environment.